Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, April 22nd. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Southern Humboldt Housing Opportunities awarded $3.5 million to Advance Housing Initiative. Details on the imperiled Trinity River. And ceasefire advocates ask Mendocino supervisors for resolution. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Two searches are currently underway in remote portions of Humboldt County. As of news time, law enforcement, including the Hoopa Fire Department and Hoopa Tribal Police, are currently searching for a juvenile male along the Trinity River near Hoopa. The search began after two juvenile males were reportedly swept away by the river's strong current around 3:40 p.m. today. One of the youths had been rescued, managing to cling to a tree along the riverbank, while the other remains outstanding. A female who initially entered the water to help and another juvenile male were also assisted back to shore by a rescue boat. High water flows from Lewiston Dam releases are complicating search efforts. Additional resources, including a civilian boat and a tribal police boat, have been deployed. Two ambulances have also been sent to the area, with the one rescued male transported to the hospital for treatment. This is a developing story, and further updates will be provided as information becomes available. In southern Humboldt, a separate incident is unfolding near the Humboldt-Mendocino County border, as deputies were dispatched at 4 p.m. on April 12th following the report of a missing 65-year-old resident of Piercy, Terry McInnes. McInnes was last seen by friends and neighbors around March 24th, and his prolonged absence was reported as highly unusual. His vehicle was later found unoccupied in the east branch of the South Fork of the Eel River, near the Humboldt-Mendocino County line, in the remote community of the Hanson Ranch. It is believed that McInnes may have tried to cross the river during a period of high water flows at the end of March, which may have led to his vehicle being swept downstream. Search efforts have included a California Highway Patrol helicopter and the Southern Humboldt Technical Rescue Team. Both Humboldt and Mendocino County Sheriff's Offices are involved in the ongoing search. Anyone with information about these cases is encouraged to contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251. Southern Humboldt Housing Opportunities is one step closer to fulfilling its organizational mission of providing adequate shelter for SoHum's unhoused population, thanks to a new state grant. The local nonprofit has recently been awarded $3.5 million. Patty Ray, SHOW's board president and longtime advocate, explains that the organization was established in response to a pressing community need. Southern Humboldt currently lacks a designated shelter, even during inclement weather, following the closure of Lee Garberville Vets Hall in 2015. The following year, members of the community began offering grassroots assistance to the area's most vulnerable population, leading to the formation of SHOW in 2018. Since then, the board of directors and supporters have been diligently working to establish a safe camp and tiny house village, which is on the verge of becoming a reality.
And we did it, SoHum! Yay!
That was Patty Ray sharing her excitement on the recent allotment of $3.5 million from the Encampment Resolution Funding Program grant. Following the state's appropriation of $400 million in 2022 to assist local jurisdictions in ensuring the safety and wellness of people experiencing homelessness in encampments, and help transition individuals into safe and stable housing, using a data-informed, coordinated approach.
This funding provides our community with transitional emergency housing to the tune of $3.5 million for a 3-year project that will assist our homeless to permanent housing. Isn't that great? This funding covers purchase of property and upgrades to outreach workers, a rapid rehousing person, security, secured sleep areas, and oversight of the 10 sleeping areas and 5 car camps. People will receive services to help them adjust from 24/7 survival mode to consistently feeling safe, fed, and sheltered, this leading to a permanent housing situation.
SHO has created a strategic plan that will be implemented over the next 3 years, which includes expanding their services, creating a safe camp resource center, and implement a transitional housing program.
People that are living outdoors, it's not easy for them to transition into indoor living. And so a safe camp would allow people that want to be in a tent, be in a tent, but also have amenities of being in a secure or safe. As we know, there's darn villains out there that are preying upon a lot of our unhoused people. But it gives them an opportunity, you know, to be a part of building community within themselves, because they like living differently than we do. And so we would actually support that, meet them where they are, so to speak.
In addition to the safe camp, SHO plans on constructing a tiny house village, which, as defined by the county's housing element, is a grouping or clustering of 3 or more tiny houses that are either movable or detachable, with sanitary, laundry, cooking, and dining facilities.
Providing kitchen and showers and laundry and facilities that will make things easier for our friends, our community members. And fortunately for us, everything is going in that direction as far as the county and the ordinances and, you know, allowing for people to have these independent living units on their property. And this is going to play right into what we're doing. So all the cards, everything's falling into place. We're pretty excited about it.
The County Planning Commission took up its draft Tiny House Village and Emergency Housing Village Ordinance on April 18th, which, once passed, will allow for zoning changes that aim to remove the barriers to creating these sites. But Ray says SHO isn't stopping there, and the group also is working to provide transitional housing, which helps to transition residents into permanent affordable housing.
The time in transitional housing will probably average about 4 months. $1.4 million is for a pool of funds to assist and support in paying rent over 2 years. This gives landlords a guarantee of rent being paid. Those participating in this program who are physically able can earn money stipends in exchange for work, helping to cover their personal expenses and whatnot. We are largely serving longtime locals who found themselves without shelter for one reason or another and need our help. 31 people that I know that were born and raised here or have been here over 15 years. So we're helping our own is what we're doing.
SHO board member Diana Coppythorne believes that the transitional housing facility will help to launch community-wide revitalization.
I strongly believe that SHO is doing the groundwork to help bring positive change to our community. The foundation of SOHUM is strong. There is already a deep sense of community, feeling connection and supporting one another. There is cohesion, being able to work together, and a really strong history of collective action and advocacy on projects that are needed in the community. The ripple effect, though, will be improving the quality of life for everyone in SOHUM. An opportunity for us all to work together, bring about long-term community change.
This grant requires recipients to spend at least 50% of the funds by June of 2025. And Ray says SHO is hitting the ground running.
We do not want to have people out in the winter next year. So our goal is to have this up and running. And while we're doing this transitional sheltering, emergency sheltering, we will also be looking for grants and going towards the Safe Camp and Tiny House Village funding.
Sho has identified a property and is hoping to begin the escrow process before the end of summer, and will share more details once things are finalized. And in the meantime, Ray says she will continue to work closely with members of the houseless community.
In fact, the Constitution, which was created 5 years ago, which is Camp Rules, was done by three people in the camp that we'll be using, you know, as guidelines. So absolutely, they have to be a part of all this. We've been building bridges.
At a homelessness town hall in Redway in 2022, Humboldt County Sheriff William Hansel announced that he supports the idea of a safe camp because it removes enforcement restrictions on individuals camping on state land. However, some community members aren't convinced and describe the project as enabling. We asked Ray to comment.
What I can say to that is, after somebody's been down on luck and having to live out in the elements and dealing with constant 24/7 survival mode, they need a little help. And the last thing I'd want to do is enable anybody. What I'd like to see is empowering people. And part of that will be developing cottage industries and ways for people to be able to start working when they're healthy enough. It's going to take a minute, you know, to heal from so many years of being outside. But I see good things on the horizon as far as empowering people.
Southern Humboldt Housing Opportunities will be tabling at the Daisies in Redway on May 4th and at the Daisies in Garberville on May 31st, and invite anyone with questions or concerns to drop by.
This program is a stepping stone to a safe camp and a tiny house village to help our local unhoused. Through joint effort of not only our community, but also the county and state reps, we can provide services that address the lack of housing, health, and safety for those who are homeless in our community. So we're all working together, like our community always does and always has done. And it just thrills me that we're able to do this.
Copythorne also encourages others to get involved.
Sho is really shaped by the people who are actively participating, the board members, the volunteers. We all make it up. We'd like to be more visible in the community so people can see the work that we're doing and hopefully get some fundraisers up and running this year, because even with the grant money, we still need basic funds to have the overhead costs and to, you know, keep things running while we're getting things in place. And again, we welcome everybody's input and, you know, questions. Please come out and talk with us, see what we're up to, take part. And today we would like to extend that invitation to all of you who feel the call to join us in our effort. Just remember that everyone out there has the power to make a difference and be a part of this amazing journey.
You can learn more about Southern Humboldt Housing Opportunities and their projects at sohumhousing.org. KMA News will continue to share updates as the project unfolds. The Trinity River is under complex legal and political pressure, with a history that spans 70 years back to European colonization. KMA News, Kelly Lincoln, spoke with Hoopa Valley Tribal Fisheries Director Michael Orcutt to gain perspective.
As you may have read, AmericanRivers.org released their annual list of the top 10 most threatened rivers in the United States this week. Sadly, our local Trinity River is number 7 on the list. On the listing, American Rivers writes the threats are excessive water withdrawals and inadequate temperature protection. They also write, quote, "The Trinity River, the largest tributary of the Klamath River, plays a significant role for salmon, steelhead, and green sturgeon. The Trinity holds remarkable value to wildlife and people. The Hoopa Valley and Yurok tribes have been stewarding and defending the river for generations, fighting for tribal rights and environmental justice for the people and the waters. The Trinity is threatened from excessive water diversions, new water demands, and the effects of drought and climate change. We must tell the California State Water Resources Control Board to honor tribal water rights, protect carryover storage, and maintain cold water temperatures on the Trinity River. KMUD News spoke with Michael Orcutt, longtime fisheries director for the Hoopa Valley Tribe, this Friday morning. In a nearly hour-long conversation that included history that goes back to the 1950s and which was peppered with legal decisions, bureaucratic jargon, and infinite detail, Michael Orcutt explained that the Trinity is over-allocated and the tribe's a priori water and sovereignty rights are tangled up in the political interests of those trying to lead the state and the nation. When the Trinity River was first dammed in the 1950s, 90% of the water from the North Fork of the Trinity River, which comes off of Scott Mountain and the west side of the Trinity Mountains as far south as Browns Creek, which is south of Weaverville, was diverted to the Central Valley. This is the far bigger side of the Trinity River. Orcutt explained that in the 1970s, the tribe lost a lawsuit on Trinity River flows, but gained sovereignty rights.
The 90% reduction almost was a 70 to 90% reduction in the fish population. So Trinity County and Hoopa enjoined a lawsuit against Secretary Andrus. The secretary prevailed because it's an interior project under the Bureau of Reclamation. What Cecil Andrus also did was, and it was right at the time that there was a real presence in the Klamath and Trinity basins of what were called federally reserved fishing rights. But the government said, yes, these two reservations, Hoopa Valley and Yurok Reservation, these two tribes have what's called a reserve right to that fishery. So Secretary Andrus said, even though I won the lawsuit, I'm going to start a flow study. And that began in 1984. And they added a provision specifically to the Trinity River. It's section 3406B23 that said, complete the flow evaluation, among other things, restore the pre-dam levels of fish populations. It also said that it was in order to meet the trust responsibility to the Hoopa Valley Tribe, and it also said when this flow study was done and the restoration plan was going to be implemented, it said it needed to be concurred in, and that was a very, very, it's being tested as we speak.
That flow study ended up with the Trinity River getting 50% of its flows rededicated to it, but the concurrence of the tribes is being tested. Under the Trump administration, those rights began being challenged as water contracts with Southern California contractors were made permanent.
Attempted to convert their interim contract to a permanent contract when they were being assessed for how much their debt was. They paid off the construction part of it, but the environmental restoration was not paid for. And the estimates as recently as 2013, I think that's right, were $342 million is what they owed for the environmental restoration. And that just simply was beneficiary user pays for the environmental restoration, which makes a lot of sense to us. The Trump administration wrote off that debt.
Those contractors are very powerful folks that you hear a lot about, the ones who say little fish are being put ahead of people and farmers. Even the Biden administration seems to be concerned about them.
When we went into our litigation, the court even said at one point, when it changed to the Biden administration, and us really being enthused that Deb Haaland, a Native Indigenous person, was going to be the Secretary of Interior, the court even paused and says, do you want to reassess and reevaluate your position? And despite that opportunity, the Biden administration continues to support that action, which is writing off the debt. One of the other things that has emerged is that concurrence question is, well, was that one and done, so to speak? And that's kind of what the message we've been chasing and attempting to meet with Secretary Haaland or their representatives to talk about it, and just haven't had fair opportunity despite attempting to reach a settlement of our litigation.
When I asked California State Water Policy Analyst and former Trinity County Principal Planner Tom Stokely about the disparity of Governor Newsom's trip to Humboldt County in March and his water plan stating support for salmon recovery, Stokely's answer implied the governor also seems to be worried about the water contractor's political power.
They're picking the low-hanging fruit, but they're not making the hard decisions, which is to cut back the over-allocation of water in California. I mean, the bottom line is that consumptive water demands are 5 times the actual supply of water in California during an average year. During a drought, it's even worse. And yet, the governor basically plans to continue to give the senior water contractors, Westlands or whoever, they have no intention of cutting back on these water deliveries to save the fish. So they're basically moving our salmon resources to extinction. And it's smoke and mirrors.
Hoopa Valley Fisheries Director Michael Orcott explained why the cold water pool in Trinity Lake needs to be deep.
It's almost 85% full. 2.45 million, almost 2 years worth of rainfall can be stored in Trinity River Reservoir. It stratifies. When you draw it down to certain levels and the infrastructure that exists today, there's only limited opportunities to control the temperature, but the lake is stratified and there's cool water below there, but it goes away when you get down to how far you're drawing the reservoir. In the past drought years, we've been down as low as about 1/5 or in the order of 400,000 to 500,000 acre feet. It actually is about 900,000 when you start to get into problems with temperatures.
For more information on the impacts to the Trinity River, some good, mostly pretty bad, from California State Water Policy, check out the Community Affairs Hour last night, which is an extended interview with Tom Stokely. That was Thursday, April 18th at 5 p.m. This is Kelly Lincoln reporting on the imperiled Trinity River for KMUD News.
Turning to Mendocino. Ceasefire advocates ask the Mendocino Board of Supervisors for a resolution. KZYX's Sarah Reith reports.
Advocates for a ceasefire in Gaza lined up last week to ask the Board of Supervisors for a ceasefire resolution. And Mendocino Railway spoke out against the Great Redwood Trail's plans to railbank the northern portion of the track, writing in a letter to the board that the county is missing out on the opportunity to use federal infrastructure money to reconnect the local rail to the national system. Megan Wolf encouraged supervisors to follow the Fort Bragg City Council's lead in drafting a ceasefire resolution. The Ukiah City Council tabled a similar resolution, meaning they did not vote on it, but they could still revisit the item in the future. The council in Ukiah heard hours of testimony from city residents both for and against the resolution, while in Fort Bragg, public opposition at the city council venue was minimal. In Ukiah, community members opposed to the resolution urged the council to focus on local matters rather than global affairs. Wolf, who said many of her Jewish ancestors were killed in a Polish death camp during World War II, believes the conflict is a local issue.
Because our community is affected by it. We have Palestinian Americans in our community watching their homelands and cultural sites being destroyed, loved ones in grave danger or murdered. A ceasefire resolution tells our entire community that we do not support genocide and we do not want our tax dollars funding it.
About 10 members of the public addressed the board to ask for a ceasefire, while 2 cautioned against it. One was Helen Sizemore, who predicted that a resolution would be divisive. She urged people to represent themselves, in their own words.
If every person that wants a resolution wrote a letter to the president, the effect would be tremendous. There are people that want a ceasefire, but they do not want to lose the state of Israel. The anti-Zionist actions of a resolution threaten the existence of a Jewish state.
Robert Gitlin called in to tell the board that Hamas had murdered his cousin at the Nova Music Festival on October 7th and to remind the public of the atrocities committed on that day. He also called attention to anti-Semitic hate crimes in the U.S. since the conflict started, and he's not sure a ceasefire would be honored on all sides.
We need to remember, as people call for ceasefires, that let's never forget that there was a ceasefire in effect on October 6th. And you know what a ceasefire looks like with Hezbollah right now in Yemen and Iran. There are only missiles flying at Israel every day, and that's what ceasefire looks like.
William Troino said Gaza is in ruins.
Civilian neighborhoods have been razed to the ground. The civilian population has been denied access to safe drinking water and electricity. Every hospital in Gaza has been destroyed. Every university has been destroyed. Everything that a population needs to survive has been systematically destroyed. Now the people of Gaza are starving to death.
Supervisor John Haschek said he plans to write an individual letter
calling for a ceasefire, for humanitarian aid, and release of hostages, because I think that we all need to do our part. And I don't know if the board wants to take it up, but I think as individuals, we do need to make our statements and make our voices heard. So if anyone wants to join me in that, you're more than welcome. I will have it for public access.
In a long-running controversy of less global proportions, Robert Pannoli, the president of Mendocino Railway, shared a letter arguing that rail service in Mendocino County is in jeopardy.
While the GRTA plans to leave the railroad tracks in place south of the Mendocino County border so that the people and businesses south of that border can benefit from both rails and trails, the GRTA has decided to deny those same benefits to the people and businesses of Mendocino County.
Pannoli added that the GRTA's efforts to cut Mendocino County off from our national railroad network seem to be doing exactly the opposite of what our federal government is seeking to accomplish with billions of dollars in transportation initiatives. Supervisor Dan Jurdy doesn't think the rail can be rehabilitated without a local tax.
As you know, and the voters of Sonoma and Marin County have voted to put in a quarter-cent sales tax to support the creation and funding of the Sonoma-Marin Rail Authority, SMART. And that quarter-cent sales tax, again, voted by a supermajority of the voters of Marin and Sonoma County in order to dedicate that tax for that purpose. I've often over the years heard people advocate we need to have rail in Mendocino County, but I've yet to hear anybody convincingly say that they're going to campaign for a quarter-cent sales tax to bring rail to Mendocino County, which, you know, we have very little sales tax in Mendocino County compared to Sonoma and Marin. Are you saying that you would head up a campaign to create a quarter-cent sales tax to bring freight trains or rail service to Mendocino County, which would support the rail to support freight?
That's not what I was saying. I'd be certainly happy to work with a task force to accomplish that for the betterment of Mendocino County. What I said is that there is $3.3 billion available presently, right now, by the Biden administration for communities that one time had rail or transportation connectivity that has been disconnected.
Yeah, just my concern is there's no way for rail to work in Mendocino County without a sales tax. Otherwise, they would not have voted it in on a supermajority in Marin and Sonoma County. They have a much higher, denser population there, much more compact counties than we are. So if they take a quarter cent, we might even need half of a cent to support the same level of service that they have in Marin and Sonoma. So my concern is that the talk of rail service in Mendocino County is somewhat fantasy because there is no sales tax like there is in Sonoma and Marin.
For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Wright.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Kelly Lincoln and Sarah Wright. Reporting for KMUD in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.